Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, May the 30th, and it's time for the Friday Week in Review, where we talk with two guests from different perspectives about the news of the week, and we welcome your input too. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lots of political news in the news this week. Should Barack Obama visit Iraq with John McCain? Is Scott McClellan's new book going to hurt John McCain? How's that going to play out on the presidential campaign trail? We'll talk about those national issues and state issues as well as we welcome in our guests. Georgia Durst-Lottie is a professor of political science at Beloit College. She joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Chris Lotto is with us. He's a longtime state Republican consultant and commentator, and he joins us by phone as well. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So let's start with John McCain last night in Milwaukee. He was here for a fundraiser. And he said it's important for Barack Obama to go to Iraq so he understands what's going on there. Georgia Durst-Lottie, important for Barack Obama to go visit Iraq?
Well, it certainly is now.
Why?
Because McCain set it up, so he has to. and the number count of days is really a brilliant tactic. When our top people go, they are absolutely surrounded and buffered from what's going on. So, you know, the casual stroll through the marketplace that McCain had was, you know, a photo op made possible by enormous numbers of troops around him the last time he was there. On the other hand, having traveled to weird places in the world, it is true that if you go there, you can see and get a feel for the place. And so, you know, there will be, no doubt, some advantage for him going. The thought of him going with McCain, I mean, you know, that is just ludicrous in terms of presidential politics.
But he is now, Chris Lotto, Barack Obama's campaign anyway, saying he's considering a trip to Iraq this summer.
Well, yeah, and I think by doing that, they're acknowledging that they need to go at some point. I think McCain did a good job on calling him on that, and to have avoided going to Iraq for more than 2 years, the perception matters. And for him to appear to be an authority and try to build his foreign policy bona fides, you know, Barack Obama has to appear engaged and involved. And I think that's one way he does it, by going to Iraq. And one thing that the professor mentioned, you know, I did think it was a brilliant stroke for John McCain to invite Barack Obama along. I mean, she referred to it as being a ludicrous idea. I think it's a great idea. The first thing I thought of when I heard that, I thought it was, well, that would be a neat bipartisan thing to see the presidential candidates from the opposing two parties go together. I mean, I think that's the way John McCain operates, and I think that's a great example of that.
Mm-hmm. Neat bipartisan, move there, which, of course, makes in this setting John McCain the elder statesman and Barack Obama the neophyte, and that's why it's brilliant as a tactic, as a request, but ludicrous to think about in presidential politics. It's not a bipartisan move, and McCain isn't nearly as bipartisan as both the Republican conservatives who really don't like it when he does jump ship, and is sort of the maverick image he's cultivated so well. He's not as maverick as he seems, and he's not as bipartisan as he seems, and this will just never happen in presidential politics.
Let's take a listen to John McCain. He was talking about this at a campaign stop in Reno, Nevada on Wednesday.
He could meet General Petraeus, and he could meet Ambassador Crocker, and he could see the fact that Sadr City is quiet. He could see that with the Maliki government has taken control of Basra. He could see that the Iraqi military is leading the fight in these places with the support of American troops.
He also, in that speech, made the point that Barack Obama is willing to meet with the leaders of Iran and Syria and these other countries, but not apparently willing to meet with the commanders of our troops in Iraq. Georgia Durst-Lottie?
Well, that's campaign rhetoric and hyperbole. He, of course, can meet with them. The question is, does he meet with them in Iraq? And, you know, the whole notion of having avoided going it's not as though the troops and the army and our military forces really want these high-profile people coming through because they really distract from their mission. So, I mean, you know, he'll go, I'm sure, because he cannot not go now. You know, he has actually talked to Crocker and Petraeus when they testify before the Senate, so it's not as though he hasn't talked to them. It's whether he's been there and seen it and, you know, really to assess the value of this. But as I said, you know, there's no way he cannot go now because McCain and the Republican campaign has really done a good job of setting him up, so he has to go.
Well, you know, it's very telling that Barack Obama's campaign, their response to this challenge that he's willing to meet with the leaders of Iran and Syria and not meet with General Petraeus, their response is, well, you know, he saw him at a hearing. Well, yeah, we all saw General Petraeus at a hearing. Turn on C-SPAN, you can see General Petraeus at a hearing. I mean, the point that John McCain is effectively making here is that Barack Obama has to be more engaged. I mean, in order to have a better, fuller opinion of what's going on in Iraq and what needs to happen going forward, he should be there. He should go.
Well, once he has the nominee, when he's the presumptive, which he's not quite there yet, then he would have better standing to actually have one-on-one meetings with mm-hmm. these two important political figures wherever. And until he does, he really doesn't have access more than as a senator. So, you know, going there, being more engaged, you know, this is really important to him. And Chris, you make a good point that this is one of the areas that the Republicans are certainly going to come after him.
Let me bring in a caller. Ned in Wausau. Hi, Ned, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to bring up something about John McCain. He's trying to reinvent himself as a maverick, which in his voting record does not support that. He actually has supported Bush 92% of the time on bills in Congress. And now, in his fundraisers this week, he's not allowing the press to come in.
Yeah, what about that, Chris Lotto? The president held some fundraisers for him, and he didn't really want to appear with him. John McCain didn't really want to make that appearance together.
Well, regarding the press and fundraisers, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a typical thing. The press is not allowed in fundraisers, and that goes for candidates on both sides of the aisle. I mean, that's the way it happens. The press obviously covered a town hall meeting with Senator McCain before. I understand there's a news conference going on today, so there are going to be plenty of opportunities for the press to speak with John McCain while he's in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Georgia Derslati?
Well, as I said, he's not much of a maverick, and, you know, his voting record is how one would measure that, and he's just not much of a maverick. I think because Bush's polls are so low that he's rather like Clinton was for Gore in 2000, that, you know, he can't be painted as too close to him, and of course the Democrats are going to try to do that.
Well, I think that's interesting. I know that everybody's using this line McSame, and there's this effort to tie him directly to Bush. I think John McCain has proven over the years that, yes, he does have a largely conservative voting record, but he is his own man, and he is his own thinker. And it's no secret that he has disillusioned large sections of the Republican Party over the years with some of his stands. And this attempt now to say, well, he's going to be Bush 2, he's going to be McSame, I think is going to fall flat. I think John McCain has a lot of appeal to Reagan Democrats, independents, certainly in Wisconsin. If I could tell a brief story about 2004, John McCain was in Wisconsin as a surrogate for President Bush mm-hmm. and was in Madison. I accompanied him on the Capitol Square, and we were walking him, you know, with no big contingent, no big entourage around him, from the Inn on the Park to the nearby Veterans Museum. There were some protesters out there, some Bush protesters. John McCain went right up to them and talked to them, engaged them in a conversation for 10 minutes. And the protesters were almost sad or upset to have to be there to protest John McCain. It seemed like they sincerely liked the guy and were disappointed that he was supporting Bush at the time and was there, you know, for a campaign event. What struck me is that John McCain engaged them, talked to them, reached out to them, listened to what they had to say. You know, I don't know that he changed any minds there that day, but he did engage them, and I think that's the way John McCain operates, and I think that's what scares the Democrats so much, is that he is willing to do that kind of thing, to reach out to the other side. He's not afraid to do that.
Mm-hmm. Georgia Derslati?
I think Chris is right that this really does show some of his talents, and that this is what the Democrats worry about.
We will talk about Scott McClellan's new book and his criticisms of the White House coming up after this break, and we will welcome your thoughts and questions on that and other issues in the news this week at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is The Week in Review, talking with Georgia Durst-Lottie and Chris Lotto. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with John Munson filling in for Ben Marins, and it's your views on the news after 4 o'clock. You can call in with what you think is the top news story of the week after 4 o'clock. We're reviewing all of the significant political news stories of the week this hour with our two guests, and our next issue is going to be talked about by Paul in La Crosse. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, this the new book by Scott has been, as you know, raising a lot of things. What surprised me was this morning in the Wall Street Journal, Peggy Noonan writes about it, and she, at the end of the story, she's at the end of her column, she writes that she believes Scott. She says that what he's saying is true. I haven't heard any Republican, any conservative, any Bush supporter say that Scott is lying. If he's telling the truth, how does that change the for discussing the war in Iraq?
Let's start with Chris Lotto.
Well, I haven't read the book yet. I've actually tried to get my hands on a copy, but I made a couple calls around to some local bookstores, and they're already out. So it's obviously moving fast and selling like hotcakes. So what I know is, you know, what I've read of the news articles, and I did read Peggy Noonan's article. And one of the key points that Peggy Noonan makes is that, you know, it is important to get as many different points of view as possible for this presidency, and certainly the insiders, to get them to speak out if they're willing to do so, and to get as many perspectives as possible to help paint a complete picture of the Bush administration. Now, having said that, what I know about the book, the idea that Scott McClellan was perhaps kept in the dark and didn't know everything that he should have known, that doesn't necessarily surprise me. I can see a scenario under which, in order for Scott McClellan to present the point of view that the administration wanted him to, that they would be selective in the information that they give him. Although, by the same token, it is then Scott McClellan's responsibility to make sure he has all the information. And if he doesn't do it, then he's derelict in his duties. I mean, I'm looking forward to reading this book. I think it'll be fascinating. I'm looking forward to his point of view. I obviously can't say whether he's, you know, lying or not. My issues are more with somebody who was a trusted confidant of the Bush administration, comes out before President Bush has left office and writes this book that seems kind of bitter, kind of sour grapes. We can argue about the veracity of what he's saying, but let's face it, you know, Bush bashing right now is a cottage industry, and Scott McClellan wrote a book that obviously will sell very well. So, you know, good for him as far as it goes.
Georgia?
The press secretaries are in a funny situation. To say that he was supposed to have voiced his opinion as the deputy press secretary at the beginning when they were actually doing the planning, which is what Karl Rove was saying he should have done, it's just ridiculous because they aren't brought in. They can present themselves better if they don't know everything. I mean, otherwise it comes down to how well can they lie straight-faced. And so it's not unusual for press secretaries to not be entirely in the inside, and there's some reasons for that. Brett Hume yesterday went on and on about what a bad press secretary he was, and I thought the personal attacks were most unfortunate, and those personal attacks are not coming from the insiders, the Bush loyalists. So, you know, to have this outsider with such a platform doing the personal attack, I thought was unfortunate because, is he a good press secretary? Is he not a good press secretary? Back to Paul's question, does this change anything? I think what this does is reaffirm what we already know now. And the question is, how much do you believe that the buildup to the war really was not based upon some good policy, but instead, a desire to make the administration look tough and big, to finish daddy's war? I mean, all the things that have floated around out there and different political points of view will express them in different ways, focus in on different things. But I think this just reaffirms what we already know about the way we got into this war and the mistake that it was.
Yeah. Here's what the Obama campaign issued when the book came out. On the day after former White House press secretary conceded that the Bush administration used deception and propaganda to take us to war, it seems odd that Senator McCain, who bought the flawed rationale for war so readily, would be lecturing others on their depth of understanding about Iraq. So, Chris Lotto, is this going to hurt McCain?
I don't see how it does. I mean, you know, we all need to remember back when getting into the Iraq War was the issue, that Democrats and Republicans, bought into it. And I think, does this hurt John McCain? John McCain has acknowledged that mistakes have been made throughout the process, but that things are getting better in his view, and that things are improving, and that to get out of Iraq now, in his view, would be a mistake. He has acknowledged, again, that mistakes have been made, but thinks that going forward, there is a way for us to, achieve what would be called victory, and to do it in a time frame that is reasonable, as opposed to Barack Obama's idea that we just pull out immediately or as soon as possible and leave everything in chaos. And that would be a mistake in John McCain's view. I don't see how this hurts him. I mean, what McClellan is saying is very specific to President Bush and the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. Georgia?
I think this is a similar argument that they've used against Clinton, because she, like McCain, voted for the war, given the information that came out from the administration at the time. And, I guess this isn't a surprise that they would issue this kind of statement. And I just want to call Chris here on one thing, and that is to pull out as soon as possible. It is going to be very, very difficult to pull out soon. And all of the Democratic candidates, even back when there were more of them in, or most of the Democratic candidates anyway, by the time we got close to picking, when you're down to three, they all were talking about how hard it's going to be to get out of there. And that is the reality, which is why you don't go to war the way we did. You don't go for propaganda reasons. You don't go because you get caught up in the partisan fights and winning or wanting to look good and spin. I mean, you don't go to war for those reasons, because it's so serious, and that's what I think McClellan's telling us, and it just reaffirms what we know and was bad.
Yeah. Tom in Wausau, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, my feelings are is probably what he was mainly trying to do is he didn't agree with what he had to say, and he was trying to clear his own mind, his own self, just because, he didn't agree to what he was told to be telling the people, and he wanted to let it out knowing that that's the way he felt. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton reacted to the book by saying that McClellan is essentially apologizing for having been a part of misleading America for 3 years. So is this trying to get rid of some guilt, do you think, Georgia Drislotti?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think in part he felt duped. So if he was supposed to be loyal, he didn't feel that he was put in a position that served his own integrity well, and I think this has a lot to do with his personal integrity. I mean, he's basically said as much. And the other thing that that struck me when I first heard about the book was that he probably went to Washington, like many who enter politics, and Chris is certainly more involved directly in politics than I, because he really believed in something, and the whole experience showed him that the very thing he went there for wasn't happening, didn't happen, and, basically McClellan said this as well, so that his idealism was dashed. The reason he did politics was dashed. And so I think this is, whether it's guilt or not, I think all of these reasons are entwined in why he would come out with a book like this.
Last word on this one, Chris Lott.
Yeah, trying to plumb the depths of why he did what he did. I'm sure he talks about it in his book and explains where he's coming from and why he's doing what he's doing. I think there are ways to talk about these things. I think, you know, maybe it's the cynic in me who says there are other ways to talk about this than to write a book that you know is going to be a bestseller because you're bashing a sitting president and you work closely with him for a few years. I mean, that's the part that bothers me. You know, sit down, do an interview with, you know, network news, something like that. I think there are other ways to go about it than basically, I think, to submit a book form resume to get a job for a network news or something like that, which is what I think is part of this. I mean, I think it maybe, again, I'm being cynical here, but, you know, part of it is maybe to clear his conscience. Part of it is to, you know, build a post-White House career for himself. And I think at that, he's so far been very successful.
Former President Bill Clinton on the campaign trail for his wife this week, and he was upset that the media are treating this race on the Democratic side as if it's over. He says it is not over, and there are Michigan and Florida to consider.
Why are they doing this? Because if you vote for her and she does well in Montana and she wins in Puerto Rico, when this is over, she will be ahead in the popular vote. And they're trying to get her to cry uncle before the Democratic Party has to decide what to do in Florida and Michigan, because they are claiming that it only takes 2,029 votes on the first ballot to win. It takes a lot more than that if you put Florida and Michigan back in.
Yeah. Georgia Durislati, Michigan and Florida, a big deal. Will that put Hillary Clinton over the top?
It won't put Hillary Clinton over the top because they will never negotiate it so that it can be. She will come closer. She will not get over the top from this as nearly as I can tell, but it will be closer. I mean, you know, sometimes they talk about this, the delegates, and, you know, like there's some vast difference between the two. The point of fact is, it's still a close race. Now, is it harming the party to have her stay in? Certainly, the argument that the go-in when in disarray, that if she takes it all the way to convention, that, you know, there are many who follow that line of argument. On the other hand, it has certainly invigorated the Democratic Party and will do so in states where they haven't had much invigoration for a long time. So, you know, it's not over and it won't be over. It won't make her win by whatever they negotiate. She'll come closer, but she won't win.
Yeah, well, I did hear her on the campaign trail the other day saying, you know, every poll, every state, every independent analysis shows that I am the candidate on the Democratic side that can win the states that Democrats need to win, and that I'm the stronger candidate against John McCain in November. Is that going to make any difference?
It may well with some of the superdelegates, and I actually believe this is true. I do believe that she has a better chance of beating McCain for a whole variety of reasons, including what we're starting to see happening with Iraq, mm-hmm. And the fact that she is closer to the middle and she does win the states that the Democrats need to win. I mean, I think all of that is true. I still don't think, unfortunately, for the Democratic Party and for Hillary Clinton, that she will be at the top of the ticket. It may be that the superdelegates force Obama to take her as the vice president, and that is, in my mind, the best scenario for the Democrats to win. And I'm not sure that's going to happen. There are many insiders who say that won't happen, but to me, that's the best way if Obama will, in fact, come out of the top of the ticket, as it looks like he is.
Chris
Lattis? There's no way that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are going to be on the ticket together. That's just not possible.
Why not, Chris?
You know, I think part of it is, you know, bruised egos. I think that the two of them, there's a lot of I don't want to say hatred, but there's a lot of bad blood between those two, and I don't see how that gets mended. I think Barack Obama wants to be his own person. Barack Obama doesn't want the Clintons, and especially Bill Clinton, kicking around the White House, you know, throwing in, telling him what he ought to be doing. I just don't see that happening. It's just not reasonable, and I think that it's not going to happen. I find it interesting, based on that clip that you played, that the Clintons have gone from, you know, blaming the vast right-wing conspiracy to blaming the vast left-wing conspiracy, mm-hmm. for their problems. There is no reasonable way that Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee. That the Rules Committee is meeting for the DNC this weekend. It promises to be a real circus, and while Hillary Clinton will pick up some delegates, it won't be enough. There is no reasonable standard out there by which Hillary Clinton can be the nominee. But you know what? She does have some good points, and the professor brought these up as well, that Hillary Clinton could readily carry some states that Barack Obama simply can't. That's going to be a real problem for Barack Obama. The notion that Hillary Clinton is the better candidate against John McCain, I don't see that. I think Hillary Clinton brings way too much baggage to the table that would be she'd just get pummeled with in a general election campaign. I think Barack Obama is the more challenging of the two candidates facing off against John McCain. But Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama on the ticket together, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Some say that Hillary Clinton completely destroyed her chances of being asked to be on the ticket when she made comments, not this week but last week, about how it was in June when Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. This week, Barack Obama responded to that comment.
I think it was an unfortunate remark, but as I said today, I think that when you're on the campaign trail for 15 months, you know, you're going to make some mistakes. And I don't think that Senator Clinton intended anything by it. I think we should put it behind us.
So a little bit of airplane noise in the background there, but he says he accepts her explanation. People make mistakes on the campaign trail, and it's time to put that comment behind us. You agree, Georgia Derslotti?
Well, let me just preface this with saying Obama is best when he stays in this conciliatory mode. I mean, that's what makes him different. So when he starts to play politics like everybody else plays it, that's when he loses ground. So the way he went about putting this down, I think, is to his credit. I'll just say that I cannot tell you the number of people who have expressed fear that mm-hmm. Obama will be assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was saying basically two things. One, you know, she gave voice to what I've heard in many, many, many quarters, and I'm sometimes surprised at who says it, but I've heard a lot that, you know, they're really afraid that he'll be assassinated. So she gave voice to that. And the other thing is sort of the October surprise that comes, you know, right at the last minute that swings the election. Mm-hmm. That, you know, stranger things have happened in politics than to have something come up that totally changes the direction of a race. And I think she was alluding to that as well. I think it was unfortunate because it cued a really sad moment in our history.
Yeah. Chris Lotto?
Yeah, and, you know, what the professor just said about all those people expressing concern about Barack Obama being assassinated really, you know, saddens me that has to be such a concern in 2008, that we haven't gotten beyond these, you know, these backwards attitudes about race. I mean, it's unfortunate. I mean, this is, no matter how much I disagree with Barack Obama's politics, this is an historic moment in American history. I mean, we have an African-American presidential candidate, a very viable presidential candidate, you know, running for office. And I think that's a wonderful moment. Again, I don't agree with him. I think he's, as a candidate, a pretty shallow one. But, you know, it's just unfortunate and saddens me. And, you know, he took the high road, and that was a wise move on his part.
I just want to second what Chris said there about how unfortunate it is in this time period that we're still talking about race in this way. But we need to deal with race in this country.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to, I don't have the story in front of me, unfortunately, but I saw in the news this morning a new preacher scandal, supposedly. It's a Catholic priest who was speaking in front of Barack Obama's church in Chicago recently, I guess, and was mocking Hillary Clinton and how she thought she was entitled to be president, but then, you know, then Barack Obama took this away from her, and he was ridiculing her and pretending to cry over this. And he has since apologized. Barack Obama has chastised the remarks, and maybe we move on from here, Georgia Derslotti, or is this going to come back?
Well, it was getting loads of play yesterday afternoon on Fox and CNN. It really was this great mocking. I'm white. I'm entitled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happened? And a black man came along and took it away. And the one of the problems that the talking heads were pointing out was that people in the church stood up and cheered.
Mm-hmm.
And will he need to actually leave this church and disavow this church in order to not offend white America? I mean, that was the question that was being posed yesterday. And, you know, the ways in which this will be used against him in the general election, in the heartland, in the South. And, you know, that is, I think, the bigger point that may come out of here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it depends. You know, it's hard to hold a candidate directly responsible for what a surrogate or when you're in the audience, what somebody else says. Having said that, you will have it used against you. But what matters most, I think, is the speed and the definitiveness with which the candidate speaks out about what has been said. And if he responds to it quickly and denounces it decisively, then I think it becomes something less of a problem. Now, that church has been nothing but trouble for Barack Obama, frankly. And, you know, part of the problem is that certainly with the Reverend Wright and all the things that have come out about what he said over the years, it becomes much harder for Barack Obama to credibly denounce what was said when he sat there for years, presumably, and heard probably many similar comments to what have since become public. And he comes out at this late time and does, you know, a very political politician move and come out and condemn it. Well, why didn't you condemn it years ago? Why didn't you walk out of that church years ago? I think it speaks to, you know, the kind of person that Barack Obama is, that he would sit there and listen to that kind of stuff over a number of years and is only denouncing it now when he has to for political expediency. I think that's a valid question. But
well, the most segregated time in America is Sunday morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we definitely go to different places of worship by race in this country. And I can say, as I listen to this, from an African-American point of view, it makes perfect sense to talk about white entitlement. And, you know, I'm not surprised that African-Americans would react an affirming way when someone talks about white entitlement, because it's alive and well in this country.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trouble for Obama is that he's really sold himself as a different sort of black. And he is a different sort of black from the stereotype that white Americans have about black men. I mean, you know, of that there can be no doubt. And yet, to be part of the community is to understand the point of view of the community, and that's what's being expressed in this church.
And we'll have to pick up that topic at another time, as we have other news of the week issues to review. Coming up after this break, we'll focus in on what happened in the state of Wisconsin this week, including the Wisconsin Supreme Court reprimanding its newest member for violating the judicial code. 1-800-642-1234. If you have an item from the news this week, especially something that happened in the state of Wisconsin, we welcome your input during this Friday Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Georgia Derslotti, a professor of political science at Beloit College, and Chris Lotto, a longtime state Republican political consultant and pundit. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 8:45. Coming up after 9:00, Veronica Rickard in for Kathleen Dunn, talking with her guests about the history and theory behind liberal guilt. So you can talk about liberal guilt coming up after 9:00. We're talking with two guests from different political perspectives about the news of the week, Georgia Derslotti and Chris Lotto. And we also welcome your thoughts, your questions about things in the news this week at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Looking at my stack of stories from the state of Wisconsin, I see here that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has publicly reprimanded its newest member for violating the judicial code, the first time the court has disciplined one of its own. Justice Annette Bette Ziegler escaped Wednesday with the lightest punishment possible from her colleagues on the high court. She could have been suspended or removed from the bench, although that was considered unlikely. She was disciplined over how she handled cases while a judge in Washington County before she was elected to the Supreme Court. She admitted violating the state's code of judicial ethics while hearing cases involving a bank where her husband was a paid director. Five justices wrote the unsigned opinion. Justice Lewis Butler dissented, saying fact-finding in the case was inadequate. So, what do we make of this, Georgia Derslotti?
We make that she showed really poor judgment, which is not a good thing for a judge to do. She didn't even, she admitted, it didn't even occur to her to consult the judicial code. And that, I think, is highly problematic in her conduct. She denied it at first, and then she admitted it. Another misstep. I think two things beyond just sort of the way it played out poorly is that this is really not what we needed in a time when cynicism and trust in government is low. And the fact that they had to do something, and they did something really weak, and I understand why they might not have done more for several reasons, but, you know, we just didn't need this, and it speaks to the very, very great need of a different way of selecting our Supreme Court justices, and there are many good models out there that don't leave us with the sort of tawdry elections that we've had in the past two.
Yeah, you know, the Wire said that this is the newest, that Annette Ziegler is the newest member of the Supreme Court. That's not true. It's Michael Gableman is the newest member of the state Supreme Court, right, Chris Lotto?
Yeah, of course, he hasn't been seated yet or sworn in.
That's why they
said
that.
The most newly elected. I think, you know, this is unfortunate. I will agree with the professor to a point that, you know, it does show bad judgment. As you read this just on the face of it, you go, why wouldn't you see a potential conflict there? I mean, it seems obvious to me that if you're, you know, sitting on cases that involve a member of your family and involve financial dealings that involve your husband, you wouldn't say, gee, you know, maybe I ought not be sitting down on this one and not be taking part in it. Now, having said that, the Supreme Court took the action that it took. It took the action that was recommended by the Judicial Commission and the Judicial Conduct Panel. It was realizing that the court is nonpartisan. All of the justices of all political leanings took part and agreed together that this was the best way to punish Annette Ziegler. It may make for some uncomfortable moments in the chambers, but, you know, be that as it may, the decision has been made, and hopefully they'll be able to move on. But the thing that I'm struck by is this idea that, you know, we've had two elections now in a row where the conservative-leaning justices have won, and it seems to have liberals in a dither that, well, we need to change the rules, we need to change the system, we need to change how to elect them because our candidate didn't win. And I'm just struck by that. We all talk about how WMC ran these ads in the Gableman race and the Ziegler race. Nobody talks about how WEAC poured a ton of money into these races.
I just really think, Chris, that we shouldn't be having these kinds of ugly issue ads that really tarnish our judges. I mean, we can use the Missouri plan where the justices are appointed by the governor, selected from a list of highly qualified people certified by the board, or, you know, pick the ABA or somebody, and then they stand for election in an up or down election.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's funny because we talk about
appointing
justices.
That's the right way to select a justice. The what's been happening lately really tarnishes the Supreme Court and casts aspersions. I mean, going back to Wilcox and some of the problems he had in the way he was raising money and conflict of interest. I mean, you know, this has actually been three election cycles in a row that have really tarnished the Supreme Court. We need to do something different here.
And what we have in the state is when we have a governor able to appoint a justice, he appoints a justice who is defeated soundly in an election. And I'm talking about Louis Butler against Diane Sykes, somebody who was clearly rejected by the voters with Wisconsin.
Well, you know,
and in a sense, Jim Doyle decides to subvert the will
of the
voters of Wisconsin and puts him on the court anyway.
And
the voters get a chance to vote him, and they vote him out a second.
Yeah. You know, I hate to jump in a good debate, but we need to move on to some other issues, including, Chris Lotto, what do you think of the Assembly trying to override some of Governor Doyle's partial vetoes in the budget repair bill and failing the other
day? Well, yes. you know, it's kind of what they have to do to try and save face, because let's face it, the budget repair items that were put together were not universally loved, and we saw some of that come out of the Republican state convention recently. It's not a surprise that these things failed. I mean, there's not enough of a majority or majority opinion in the legislature to override those vetoes in the assembly. It's not necessarily surprising that they did fail, but you know, it is what it is. I mean, there is a lot of dissension in the ranks right now, and I think that's becoming apparent over what the direction of the Republican Party is. I mean, I don't think I'm giving away state secrets when I say mm-hmm. the party at the state and national levels is in a bit of disarray and trying to find its way again.
Yeah. George Gerslotti?
I agree.
Oh, that was easy.
There we go. We don't have a debate going on that one. Either of you want to comment on UW-Madison picking a new chancellor, the top pick to be the next leader of UW-Madison, hopes to start working in August before students start arriving on campus. She is the former provost at Cornell University, Carol Biddy Martin. She will she'll become the new chancellor of UW-Madison. Georgia Gerslotti?
She is a terrific administrator. I know some of her work from women's studies. She's very smart, and they certainly sing the praises from Cornell of her capacity to be a visionary who can actually draw people in and make change. I mean, it sounds like she's a terrific leader, and so I look forward to that leadership at my alma mater. The one thing that I would say, she is talking about the need to raise faculty salary. This may sound self-serving, although I'm not part of the mm-hmm. UW system. We are really hurting in our ability to compete and to stay at the top where we want our flagship institution to be. And I hope that she can do something about faculty and staff salaries if we want to stay at the top where we should be.
Yeah, do you think so, Chris Lotto?
Yeah, I mean, UW-Madison is my alma mater as well, so obviously I'm pulling for it to succeed, and it's obviously so vital to the state of Wisconsin, its image, its economy. It plays a very vital role. She's coming in at a very, very challenging time. She has her work cut out for her. The economy is not doing well right now. She has sort of laid out a preliminary agenda where she's going to be working to get higher salaries and get more money for the university. I think one of the best things that she can do is really reach out to the legislature and try to work with them in a way that I think that the previous chancellor, John Wiley, failed to do. I think that was part of the problem with the Wiley tenure, as it were, is that he didn't make that kind of effort to connect with the legislature, and I think that should be one of the highest things on her agenda, is to try and work with them rather than against them.
Well, absolutely, because and is not entirely Republican, but it is largely Republican. They act like they're anti-intellectual and do not make the connection between a fine, fine institution like the UW and the rest of the state and the state's economy. I mean, the way they bash the institution and cut it willy-nilly denies sensibility when you look at its importance to our economy.
I won't go as far as the professor in my comments, but I will say it is obviously very important, and to ignore the system or cut it, you do so at your peril and at the peril of the state's economy and its infrastructure.
Well, there was another big front-page story in the State Journal this week. I talked about it on this program, too, that for the first time in a long time, Wisconsin dropped out of the top 10 list of the highest tax states in the nation. And what are we, number 11 or 12 now? Anyway, we dropped out of the top 10. How significant is that, Chris Lotto?
Well, I think we ought to print up T-shirts that say we're number 11 and celebrate that in the streets.
and the T-shirt ought to say, yay, more fees, more hidden costs.
Well, that's true. I mean, we under the Doyle administration have found a way to raise the revenue without actually calling it a tax, although I think you can make a pretty good argument that it is a tax. You know, there are a number of different measurements out there. We are still a high-tax state. There's no doubt about it, and I don't think anybody would disagree with you on that. The question becomes, is this legislature and this governor willing to do what it takes to cut costs where necessary, to bring things in line with people's ability to pay taxes in this state? Are they willing to make some tough decisions? Are they willing to alienate certain segments of this state to bring our spending in more line with our ability to pay? I think that's what needs to be the focus going forward, and unfortunately for too many legislatures and for far too long, that has not been the focus.
Well, I would not disagree that we need to think carefully about how we spend. But, you know, it's Republican rhetoric to talk about high tax, high tax, high tax. If you look at where we stand in states in terms of spending, we're kind of right in the middle. And that is a much better measure of how we're doing in terms of what we actually provide from the state and where, you know, are we being extravagant or not. And we never hear that number come out of a Republican's mouth.
Republican presidential hopeful John McCain has tapped Michael Duffy to manage his campaign in Wisconsin starting on June the 9th. This appointment was announced this week. Do you know who Michael Duffy is, Chris Lotto?
I do. I did work alongside him in 2004. I was with the state Republican Party as communications director at the time, so I know Michael Duffy and know of him. I think he's a good choice. He understands what needs to happen on the ground at the grassroots level, young, energetic. The McCain campaign has also picked up the current political director for the state Republican Party, Justin Johnson. He was, an instrumental part of J.B. Van Hollen's big surprise win in 2006, pulling a Republican statewide victory in a year that definitely went Democratic. So these are people who understand what it's going to take to get John McCain to win in Wisconsin. They know what it takes, along with Sarah Simmons, another former party person who's involved, I believe, in policy. They're making some good moves here, and I think that these are people who understand what it takes to get John McCain across the finish line and have him win in November in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and Georgia Drisolotti, you think eventually it will be somebody running Barack Obama's campaign in Wisconsin?
Eventually. I mean, this points to the problem of still not being decided, right? That McCain is able to move on to the general and has been for months, and the Democrats are not quite there yet.
Yeah. Do you think Wisconsin's going to play a big role in November in terms of who the next president will be? Very quickly, Georgia Drisolotti first?
Absolutely. We are still a swing state, and we will be a swing state in November.
Yeah, Chris Lotto?
No question. We're going to play a big role, and it's going to be a lot of fun to watch. We're going to get a lot of attention again in 2008. We're going to get spoiled if we keep getting treated like that.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us. Chris Lotto, you're a first time on the Week in Review, though you've been on other programs. I want to thank you very much for joining our Week in Review team.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And Georgia Drisolotti, as always, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Joy.
Georgia Drisolotti, professor of political science at Beloit College. Chris Lotto, longtime state Republican political consultant. We thank them both for being with us, and we thank you for calling in. You know, Monday morning at this time, it's the first Monday of the month, Monday, June the 2nd, and Phil Corvo will be with us. The director of Wisconsin Public Radio tries to join us the first Monday of every month to talk with you about issues facing Wisconsin Public Radio and to hear your feedback on what you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio. So please do stay with us. Tune in Monday between 8 and 9. To talk with Wisconsin Public Radio's director, Phil Corvo. Let me thank our producers, Rob Ferret and Cynthia Schuster, produced this program, also directing and on-air producing today. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.